This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
KPFT News can be heard weekdays at 5. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. KPFT Houston.
Welcome to the New Capital Show. A pleasure to be with you this morning, October 11th. Wow, the year is going by quickly. www.newcapitalshow.com. Welcome to all listeners who join us through podcasts, and of course, welcome to all listeners who are joining us through Houston 90.1 KPFT, a member of the Pacifica Radio Network. A pleasure to be with you, as I said. We were talking last week about Ken Burns' documentary. Got a lot of response, a lot of callers wanted to get on and talk about that. One of the issues that I raised was conduct of U.S. Air Force decision makers in that war, specifically the decisions that they made to bomb civilian centers. And really, Burns' documentary and our discussion that we had last week has sent me scurrying over the past week to do lots more reading about numbers of people killed in World War II and strategies in World War II. But, you know, it's really hard to escape the idea that in this day and age we continue to see crimes committed against civilians across the world. And it's a very powerless feeling that we get sometimes, because even though these things are going on, and oftentimes they're going on in places that are militarily not strong, economically not strong, and it does seem that the wealthy nations of the world have the power to do something about it, things don't get done. And we should remember that this is going on every day. Here's from the New York Times, October 7th, a rape epidemic in Congo. Every day, 10 new women and girls who have been raped show up at a hospital, many of them sadistically attacked. The doctor says, "We don't know why these rapes are happening, but one thing is clear. They are done to destroy women." Eastern Congo is going through another one of its convulsions of violence, and this time it seems that women are being systematically attacked on a scale never before seen here. According to the United Nations, 27,000 sexual assaults were reported in 2006. In South Kivu province alone, and that may be just a fraction of the total number across the country. Said John Holmes, the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, the sexual violence in Congo is the worst in the world. The sheer numbers, the wholesale brutality, the culture of impunity, it is appalling. My friends, as we've talked about World War II and the incredible savagery that occurred in that episode of world history, we should not forget that things are occurring on a daily basis. Try to involve yourselves as you can. Try to vote your conscience for people who will take these issues to heart and will take action to deal with these issues. That's what I would ask of you as you go forward today. I'd like to turn to a couple of energy issues. A couple of energy, actually they're corporate energy news. Frito-Lay flips switch on solar power at Phoenix facility. These are going to be some articles in my ongoing belief that, in fact, corporate America is out front of the federal government, is led by Republican Party. Phoenix, October 7th, this is off of PR Newswire, which is a business newswire. I don't know, I like to see these little, just these little kind of newswire tidbits that come across from American business to see what's going on, rather than having it filtered sometimes through New York Times or Wall Street Journal. This is straight off the newswire. This is Frito-Lay's press release. Let's see what they say. Frito-Lay employees dedicated the new solar electric power system that has been installed on the roof of their Arizona service center, the company's largest distribution center in the country. The 201-kilowatt system, made up of more than 1,000 Kyocera high-output 200-watt PV modules, is the largest business-owned PV system in Arizona. The system will produce roughly 350,000 kilowatt-hours of electricity annually. That's a pretty good amount. It's a pretty good amount. It's not massive, but it's a pretty good amount. PV systems produce no emissions and utilize Arizona's solar resource to convert sunlight into electricity. And the Frito-Lay senior vice president says, in concert with PepsiCo's Performance with Purpose efforts around environmental sustainability, Frito-Lay's sustainability programs have focused on conserving vital resources and implementing environmentally friendly solutions like renewable energy. A little more global corporate news. Huge firms to press suppliers over climate. This is Wall Street Journal. October 8th, Hong Kong. A group of multinational companies is embarking on a campaign to get their suppliers to report greenhouse gas emissions, pressuring thousands of vendors and factories to show that they are taking steps to battle climate change. At least six of the world's largest companies, Procter & Gamble, Unilever, Tesco, and Nestle, will announce Tuesday that they are banding together to press their suppliers to release data about their carbon emissions and climate change mitigation strategies. The move affects plants churning out everything from T-shirts to cocoa beans to razors. My friends, you as a consumer of these companies' products have a direct impact on the actions that they take. Everything that you do, as Galen Godwin of Houston Zen Center pointed out a couple of weeks ago, just little things change the world. Little things change the world. Whenever I ask her, you know, are you getting enough attendance for this retreat that you're having? Oh, two or three, it's fine, it's enough. It never is two or three, it's always, you know, 20, 30, 40 with Galen. But, you know, when I ask her, oh, two or three, and it's good enough. Every little thing that you do, it's good enough. Every little demand that you lodge with corporations that make products that you use has an impact. Don't think it doesn't. You are an activist in your daily life. And the things that are happening to cause change in corporate America, this isn't just corporate America. Unilever is a European company. Nestle is a European company. And they are responding to both American consumers, but of course also to European consumers. The demands that you make will eventually be heard. You must make them. You must make them. Air polluter to pay $4.6 billion. One of the nation's largest power generators. This is from the AP. One of the nation's largest power generators has agreed to end a years-long federal lawsuit by paying $4.6 billion to reduce pollution that has eaten away at Northeast mountain ranges and national landmarks. The settlement requires American Electric Power, based in Columbus, Ohio, to reduce chemical emissions that cause acid rain by at least 69% over the next decade. That's good. That's a lot. 69% reduction is a lot. It also fines AEP an additional $15 million in civil penalties and another $60 million in cleanup and mitigation costs. Of course, the big news is not the $15 million, it's the $4.6 billion. Details of the agreement were provided by two people familiar with, and this has not been made public, by the way. This is something that the AP learned through leaks. Details of the agreement were provided by two people familiar with its terms who spoke on condition of anonymity Monday because it had not yet been filed in federal court. The Justice Department and the EPA declined comment. Anyway, AEP based in Ohio, as listeners of this show know, we have focused quite a bit on the fact that much of the energy that is produced, much of the electricity that is produced in the Midwest is, of course, from coal. Huge, massive, numerous amounts of coal-fired plants in the Midwest. These plants have produced for decades, if not a century or more now, large amounts of acid rain. As the emissions go up into the air, they're carried eastward as the prevailing winds across the globe are generally from west to east. And these pollutants are generally carried into the Great Lakes and into the northeastern states of this country, the beautiful section that we know as the Adirondacks. Many of the lakes have suffered completely, totally from acid rain, and forests have been debilitated as well. There is a cost to this. First of all, it shouldn't be allowed to happen. It shouldn't be allowed to happen, but it has been allowed to happen because we have underestimated and undercalculated the cost of it happening. People are now fighting back and demanding that these things be stopped, fixed, and paid for. We're going to be taking your calls in just a bit. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. The subject that I would really like to turn to today, after we've touched on energy news and global political misery, is the Republican Party of the United States. I'd like to bring to your attention an article by David Brooks. Some of you may read David Brooks. He is the conservative op-ed writer for the New York Times. And David Brooks is a smart man, very articulate. You may have seen him as well on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He shows up on, I think it's Friday, for the weekly review. But I've had trouble reading David Brooks over the past few years because he just has seemed to be delusional. And I think many liberals who have previously liked David Brooks and found him to be one of the more cogent representatives of the conservative wing of things have also had difficulty reading Brooks. Until I had trouble reading him until just the other day when he published something that I thought was excellent. And I'd like to bring this op-ed that he wrote to your attention. Funny enough, the title of his op-ed is The Republican Collapse. And that's what I would like to talk with you about today and have you talk with me about. The Republican Party, where is it? What's going on with it? What are the prospects? How will our country and the world be affected? 713-526-5738. And to kick it off, I'd like to present to you David Brooks' ideas from his op-ed, The Republican Collapse, October 5th. David Brooks starts and says, modern conservatism begins with Edmund Burke. What Burke articulated was not an ideology or a creed, but a disposition, a reverence for tradition, a suspicion of radical change. Edmund Burke, of course, was the political philosopher who lived from about, let's say, from the mid to the late 1700s. I think he died around 1800, and is seen as the father of Western conservatism. He embraced the American Revolution and then did not embrace and spoke against the French Revolution, which would occur about a decade after the American Revolution. Again, Burke in Brooks's words says that Burke articulated an ideology, a reverence for tradition, a suspicion of radical change. When conservatism came to America, it became creedal. Free market conservatives built a creed around freedom and capitalism. Religious conservatives built a creed around their conception of a transcendent order. Neoconservatives and others built a creed around the words of Lincoln and the founders. Over the years, the voice of Burke has been submerged beneath the clamoring creeds. This is to say, the clamoring creeds of conservatism. In fact, over the past few decades, the conservative ideologies have been magnified, while the temperamental conservatism of Burke has been abandoned. Over the past 6 years, the Republican Party has championed the spread of democracy in the Middle East. But the temperamental conservative is suspicious of rapid reform, believing that efforts to quickly transform anything will have, as Burke wrote, pleasing commencements, but lamentable conclusions. What is Brooks saying? Brooks is pointing out that Burke was not a believer that societies could be wholesale overthrown and changed over overnight with any kind of positive consequence. That in fact, those types of episodes have lamentable conclusions. The world is too complex, the Burkean conservative believes, for rapid reform. Existing arrangements contain latent functions that can be neither seen nor replaced by the reformer. Brooks is saying that change comes incrementally. We have to walk before we run. We have to put one foot before the next. And of course, this is always the argument about evolution versus revolution. Burke would be a believer in evolution. George W. Bush presumably is a believer in revolution, launching armies into Iraq and blah, blah. Brooks goes on, the temperamental conservative prizes epistemological modesty, the awareness of the limitations on what we do and can know, and what we can and cannot plan. Over the past 6 years, the Bush administration has operated on the assumption that if you change the political institutions in Iraq, the society will follow. But the Burkean conservative believes that society is an organism, that custom, tradition, and habit are the prime movers of that organism, and that successful government institutions grow gradually from each nation's unique network of moral and social restraints. Again, contrast, George W. Bush, the society will follow whatever government we put in. Burke, the government will be an outgrowth of the society that exists, which is itself a function of custom, tradition, habit. And I would add, of course, going back to our old friend Jared Diamond, that those things are developments and functions of the land itself, the resources, the customs, the habits that and traditions that develop in a place are functions of how much water is there? How easy or difficult is it to grow crops? How much abundance is there? Right? The land ultimately will determine how we, the people, look. Over the past few years, the vice president and the former attorney general, that is to say, Alberto Gonzalez and Dick Cheney, have sought to expand executive power as much as possible in the name of protecting Americans from terror. But the temperamental conservative believes that power must always be clothed in constitutionalism. The dispositional conservative is often more interested in means than ends, which is the reverse of President Bush, and asks how power is divided before asking for what purpose it is used. Over the past decade, religious conservatives within the GOP have argued that social policies should be guided by the eternal truths of natural law, and that questions about stem cell research and euthanasia should reflect the immutable sacredness of human life. But temperamental conservatives are suspicious of the idea of settling issues on the basis of abstract truth. These kinds of conservatives hold that moral laws emerge through deliberation and practice, and that if legislation is going to be passed that slows medical progress, it shouldn't be on the basis of abstract theological orthodoxy. Over the past four decades, free market conservatives within the Republican Party have put freedom at the center of their political philosophy. But the dispositional conservative puts legitimate authority at the center. So while recent conservative ideology sees government as a threat to freedom, The temperamental conservative believes government is like fire, useful when used legitimately, but dangerous when not. Which is to say, Burke, the temperamental conservative, makes an allowance for the usefulness of government when it is used legitimately. Modern-day conservatism wants to kill the federal government, wants to indeed kill all governments off and replace them, as we heard on Democracy Now! Just a few moments ago with Amy Goodman, replace it with large numbers of mercenaries, whether that is in foreign military operations or in domestic social services operations. Over the past few decades, the Republican Party has championed a series of reforms designed to devolve power to the individual through tax cuts, private pensions, and medical accounts. The temperamental conservative does not see a nation composed of individuals who should be given maximum liberty to make choices. Instead, the individual is a part of a social organism and thrives only within the attachments to family, community, and nation that precede choice. I've brought this up before, how many of my conservative friends I talk to, for them, individual freedom is the be-all and the end-all. It is the god of their thought. And when I turn and say, well then, what's the point of the nation? What's the point of me being in common cause with you? What is it that we share in common as co-nationals if there is no place for common community? Burke would disagree. David Brooks is making the point. The individual is a part of a social organism and thrives only within the attachments to family, community, and nation that precede choice. Therefore, the temperamental conservative values social cohesion alongside individual freedom and worries that too much individualism, too much segmentation, too much tension between races and groups will tear the underlying unity on which all else depends. Without unity, the police are regarded as alien powers. The country will fracture under the strain of war, and the economy will be undermined by lack of social trust. To put it bluntly, says David Brooks, writing in the New York Times a few days ago, over the past several years, the GOP has made ideological choices that offend conservatives' Burkean roots. This may seem like an airy-fairy thing that does nothing more than provoke a few dissenting columns from William F. Buckley, George Will, and Andrew Sullivan. But suburban Midwestern and many business voters are dispositional conservatives more than creedal conservatives. They care about order, prudence, and balanced budgets more than transformational leadership and perpetual tax cuts. It is among these groups that GOP support is collapsing. As I brought to your attention last week, I think it was, there are surveys that are now coming out in places like the Wall Street Journal, which itself could be thought of as, in part, a bastion of Burkean thinking, but also in its op-ed area, prone to more ideological thinking. And I'm not arguing, by bringing this article to your attention, that there isn't a place for ideology, simply that the Republican Party appears to be driven now by ideology. And David Brooks, a conservative commentator, appears to agree when he says these voters care about order, prudence, and balanced budgets more than transformational leadership. And it is among these groups that GOP support is collapsing. As I pointed out in a recent survey, business groups and business people are increasingly viewing the Democratic Party as the party of balanced budgets and fiscal conservatism. And the GOP is losing its grip on the core business vote. And then Republicans, by a vote of 2-3, 66% are skeptical of free trade as it currently exists. And as I have discussed, it is vital that we have fair trade along with free trade. David Brooks sums up, American conservatism will never be just dispositional conservatism. America is a creedal nation, he understands, But American conservatism is only successful when it is in tension. That is tension, T-E-N-S-I-O-N, when it has tension, when the ambition of its creeds is restrained by the caution of its Burkean roots. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take your calls, 713-526-5738, and we will be talking about your thoughts on Republican Party conservatism. If that causes you to have any thoughts about liberalism, as always, we want to talk about that as well. 713-526-5738. This is the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold. Back in a moment. Back to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host, www.newcapitalshow.com and 90.1 FM KPFT, Houston, Texas. First up today is going to be Karen. Karen, welcome to New Capital Show. Karen, you're on.
You were saying about David Brooks' column. I didn't see that.
And yeah.
It's certainly an interesting take. I think one of the things that I'd like to see discussed more is how completely messed up the terms conservative and even liberal are these days.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mishmash. I mean,
yeah.
If you talk about the things that he's discussing vis-a-vis Burkean conservatism, Bill Clinton and his policies, for instance, during the whole Yeltsin-Russian overthrow of authoritarianism and the breakup of the Soviet Union and so forth, would be almost akin to the kinds of things that that the current administration is rushing in and doing. I mean, we got Putin's reaction and things that are happening now as a result of Clinton being almost more of an ideological free trader than a lot of Republicans might be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he did NAFTA big time. So, I mean, who is a kind of crazed Russian-there conservative these days? Some of the Democrats, and I think those that are in the great middle of free trade but not fair trade capitalism are on both sides of the aisle. You know, I think that's why the American people and a lot of voters, perhaps in the Midwest, where they're thinking about these things and the more Jeffersonian.
And Karen, it's kind of fascinating the play that Ron Paul is getting in the in the Republican...
Exactly. Huckabee, too.
In the Republican grassroots, Ron Paul, who's got, I mean, you know, he's got ideas all over the place, some of them good, some of them not so good.
Right.
And
at least he's questioning things.
At least he's questioning things, and he's kind of shaking up. And most importantly, he is bringing to the attention how, how misguided an endeavor the effort in Iraq is, and he's bringing that fully to the attention of Republican voters.
Right.
So I think that the point you make is exactly right, which is that ideologies are really in flux, and it's what I've been saying, which is that many liberals hold what I consider to be, or what traditionally would have been considered to be, conservative viewpoints, right? I mean,
exactly.
We want to preserve land. We want to preserve natural resources. We want to conserve capital. You know, this is a conservative, indeed, as you say, Burkean position
and
on
a lot
things.
Of, I think a lot of Democrats, you know, the other aspect of this thing is those who are holding more conservative values vis-a-vis the family. Now, they may not be as, you know, far right as a lot of evangelicals who, you know, have pretty far out attitudes on the right, but they too want to have their voice and say, hey, religion means social justice, religion means, you know, humanitarian values, religion means, you know, not carpet bombing people in other countries, you know, so, and also, you know, trying to keep our kids free of drugs and so forth. I just don't feel that there's any one party anymore that represents either liberal or conservative. It's a big mishmash, and it's very difficult for the voters. I think that's, it's an interesting election year because of that.
How do they make their decisions? Is it different this time? I can't imagine that people will make...
I don't know. I'm just completely flummoxed. You know,
okay.
Once in a while I'll hear Huckabee talk about how he lost 110 pounds and he feels preventative health is the way to go. And
right.
He's done great things.
Right.
And I'll say, hey, right on.
Yeah.
You know, that guy's interesting.
Right.
And then I'll hear Richardson say, you know, forget about all these sort of very, very slow, we'll be out of Iraq in 10 years' time attitude, mm-hmm. Get out to tomorrow. He sounds even better than Obama, mm-hmm. you know? I mean,
right.
It's very confusing to me.
Thanks, Karen. Great to hear from you. 713-526-5738. We're talking about... Republican Party, conservative politics, but of course, as Karen Calls indicates, we may be talking about politics, American politics in general today, and that's perfectly fine. Next up is Eddie. Eddie, welcome.
Hi. Two questions. One regarding the conservatism and the second regarding liberalism. The first being, who do you see who has reflected anywhere in the conservative landscape in the last 30 years that is reflective of this Burkean republicanism? I don't think we've seen anything close to that since Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
I think from the time of Nixon forward, the party has taken a turn for the worst, number one. Number two, I think what...
And yet, Eddie, the party has won elections.
Exactly.
And
that's what I want to get to my second point.
What has happened? Go ahead.
I think what Brooks is saying, in short, is the far right, the religious conservatives, the evangelicals have ruined my party. What has happened to my party? I think that's what he's saying. Yet, as you say, they continue to win elections. And this is my philosophy as far as my party is concerned, because I am a registered Democrat. I consider myself a liberal, a proud progressive, is that the far left has ruined my party. That these people, I think you're wrong. I don't think they've lost the business middle. I think these people vote against gay marriage. They vote against the far left. They vote against abortion rights. But what they get is tax cuts for the rich, deficit spending. Everybody knows there's not going to be a constitutional amendment against gay marriage, but they get these votes. And I think what proves my point is the re-election of George Bush. Because even if you say, oh, well, Al Gore won, you know, that election was stolen. Guess what? It shouldn't have been that close.
Mm-hmm.
They screwed up the country so bad,
mm-hmm.
it should have never been that close. And you know why it was? Because these people are voting their hearts, and their hearts don't want to cater to this 1-3% of the country that is clamoring for, you know, gay marriage and things like that. Mm-hmm. I think we've got bigger fish to fry as a party, as a liberal party. When you see things like Katrina, we've got bigger fish to fry than whether or not gays get to marry. And I think we need to take a serious hard look at ourselves if we want to start winning elections again.
Eddie, thanks.
Thank you.
Great call by Eddie. You know, I commented last week on this continuing focus in the Republican Party on tax cuts, right? We've got a long-term capital gains tax rate that's at 15%. As many of you know, very, very extremely wealthy people earn the vast majority of their money. Their wealth comes from investments, not from income. Not true in all cases, but for many of the very, very wealthy, the vast majority of their incomes comes from appreciation. The vast majority of their wealth comes from appreciation on investment. And that is the lowest tax in the land, 15%. income tax rates, of course, have fallen as well since the time of Ronald Reagan. And I'm beginning to see more and more focus by the mainstream media on this focus by current Republicans running for president. Romney, Giuliani, Fred Thompson. They're still talking about tax cuts. 25 years after taxes were cut. And since they began to fall, they are continuing to talk about tax cuts. Now, how effective is that going to be for conservative voters who are like, I've already got my tax cut. You know, what's next? And for liberals as well, I've already got my tax cut. What's next? And so it's contributing to the general impression that these guys just don't have much going on. As for liberals and Democrats, absolutely. Eddie's exactly right. We've got fish to fry. Liberals need to keep focused on the main issues. No question about it. Next, let's take Claire. Claire, welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, in that line of thought, for me, the main issue is the Iraq War. And because of that, I can't see myself voting for any of the Democrats except maybe Kucinich, but I don't even trust him because of what he did last time. So I'm now looking at Ron Paul. But I'm interested in the fact that as I get to know Ron Paul supporters, there's so many things that they support that I don't support, like wanting to pull out of the UN or thinking the UN is communistic. I don't know enough about Ron Paul, and this is maybe gets to the issue that you were talking about earlier for voters. How do you decide if you don't know anything about, you know, Ron Paul's his whole range of beliefs? Mm-hmm. I'm mainly for him because of his strong anti-war stance.
And are you not able to find any other candidates? That
I don't find any other except maybe Kucinich, but the last time he ran, you know, when he didn't get the nomination, he just folded. He claimed he was going to include a plank in the Democratic Party that was anti-war, I believe, but he just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
He just caved in to the leadership.
What about someone like John Edwards or?
I just see him being. They're all waffling. Well, he's waffling. He's not being strong enough. Clinton has basically said she's with the AIPAC lobby, you know, and she wants to attack Iran if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Obama said he would bomb Pakistan. So to me, these Democratic people at the front of the pack are like Lyndon Johnson. They're war Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't see have any problem with military buildup and armaments and empire and going out there and, you know, doing the quote, the liberal thing of carrying democracy to the rest of the world, which to me is a very dangerous idea.
Claire, I just don't know. I don't know that I would put it that strongly. I'm not seeing this crop of Democrats advocating war. I think that we are seeing them try to articulate some kind of strategy for elegantly extricating this country from Iraq and that they're experiencing many of the difficulties that others are experiencing. But I guess I don't share your vision that this crop of Democratic candidates is...
Well, just look at Clinton's words. when Israel bombed Lebanon last summer, she said that was the kind of American, I forget what her exact words were, but she was totally in support of that. Completely.
Yeah, and I would say that Hillary Clinton probably stands more on the conservative side of this crop of Democrats, but I think
she has definitely not said, she said, we may be in Iraq to what? 2012, we may have to go after Iran. This is very much a militaristic stance that I simply, for the first time in my life, and I'm 57 years old, I never thought this would happen. I may vote Republican.
Interesting.
Which is a frightening idea to me, but, you know.
Claire, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You know, Claire's call is exactly on point in terms of the effect that Ron Paul's candidacy is having in drawing in all sorts of strange bedfellows and what's female for fellows? Gals. Bed gals. Strange bedfellows and bed gals. Yeah. But I think that's I think this is one of the interesting things going on in American politics, is some of the slippage of orthodox views. People are letting go of those, and some other types of candidacies like that of Ron Paul are coming forward. Let's take Johnny next. What's up, Johnny?
Leo, once again, you've hit on one of my favorite topics that get me hot under the collar. This idea of Democrat versus Republican. You know, you already know, because I've said this time and again, how they're more alike than disalike. The opposite sides of the same coin. For me, the question is not so much their fiscal policy, although I am a fiscal conservative in many ways. I look more at the social policy, and not so much the social policy, but actually the actual policies that they execute, not what they say. They can talk a good game. They can talk social liberalism, but what they actually do, what they affect in the end, that's what how I measure a certain party. And as far as I'm concerned, both Democrats and Republicans fail miserably.
But Johnny, I mean, the Democratic Party in Congress and in state legislatures, you even have a Republican in California, Governor Schwarzenegger, who there is movement on expanding the scope of whether it's going to be government paid for or government executed, whatever, government involved health care, in an attempt to bring more people under coverage and to allay the risk that many people experience by not having health care coverage. I mean are is this not the far left carping that you know there's no differences between them?
Well,
your comment?
You know, one of your callers said something that irritated me. He was saying that the far left has failed, and he gave his reasons, and I disagree. I think that the left has failed, but for different reasons. Why I believe the left has failed is to reach enough people on the right, so to speak. That's to make them understand the reality that we face, the realities that we face. It's not because... how did he say it again? Now my mind is slipping. What was his reasons? He thought the left failed.
It was Eddie was saying that the far left had taken over the party and driven him out of his party and
he said that the left was harping on issues that were irrelevant, and that's the opposite. It's the far right who are doing that. They're making issues that I would say to the far right, man, we've got bigger fish to fry. Don't be harping on same-sex marriage to do away with same-sex marriage and bringing up all these non-issues. Talk about things that are really important that you're afraid to bring up.
Like what? What are they?
That you're misspending money and stealing money and conducting an illegal war, yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
That's the failure. Has nothing to do with the left or the so-called liberals or however you want to phrase them.
Yep.
That's the deal. Anyway,
thanks, Johnny.
Good show. Bye.
I agree with that. I think that in many ways the left has been sort of silenced over the past couple of decades as people have fallen in line panting like dogs with their tongues hanging out of their mouths for more tax cuts and gay marriage amendments and on and on and on. And of course, this radio show has tried to dedicate itself since the beginning to taking a look at what are the issues. I mean, clearly, I come in, I sit in the booth every week, and I try to say, here are the important issues as I see them. You know, fiscal responsibility, environmental protection. And it's not just protection. Protection implies, you know, that the environment doesn't give us anything back. We have to protect it. It's helpless and useless and worthless. No, it's not environmental protection. It's environmental costing. It's properly costing our resources. Healthcare, education. I mean, what could be more critical than the well-being of this country than education? And look at the vast coin that we are dropping in Iraq. And Iraq's the tip of the iceberg. Actually, Iraq may be the bottom of the iceberg, but you can still get an awful lot of ice as you move toward the tip of the iceberg. You know, Iraq may be the base, but move up through the other wasteful things that this Republican-led government, and at times Democratic-led government, have spent money on. No. Agricultural subsidies. Waste in the military. And on and on. Next up, let's take Mark. Welcome, Mark.
Hello, Leo.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm one of those people, like most of the people who are listening, who are in the middle. And we have been conned into this by the corporate guys whose income and stock options have skyrocketed while our standard of living and all of our earning power has been squeezed. And, you know, I was brought up on Adam Smith, who taught me to never trust anyone blindly, to always be a cognizant of con men and liars. The last Republican guy that I really worshipped was Eisenhower. I was a blind follower of Reagan, and I swallowed all of that until the no negotiation with terrorist stuff was blown away by Iran-Contra and revealed to be just a base fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
And today I am just, you know, aghast at these corporate guys who you hear all this stuff about how much money Hillary Clinton's raise and yada yada yada, but no focus on just the obscene amount of money these guys are bilking. And each time the Fed pumps in $30 billion into the stock market, these guys dump these stock options they got for nothing.
That's right.
And they suck up whatever liquidity is there in a heartbeat, and we're right back to square one. And they're calling on the government to bail them out.
I think it's a great point.
That is the most gross form of socialism that ever came down the pike. And but instead of helping the poor and the women with children that can't feed them, we're putting it in the pocket of the people with four or five homes and just so much money, it's obscene. So,
Mark, you know, thanks for the call. A pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Leo.
Yeah, we talked about stock options on this show before. What a farce that is. You can go back on the website to the show on that. I can't remember. It's probably called Stock Options, but you can find it there, and we can review the nutsiness about that. And of course, there are many, many very well-versed business people who totally disagree with the way stock options are now handed out to corporate executives. Chief among those, of course, is Warren Buffett, one of my idols, and certainly a true paragon of Burkean conservatism. You know, I got sick last night reading something. As a financial advisor, I get Financial Advisor magazine. You know, whatever business you're in, there are these trade mags, you know? I mean, every business in this country has 100, you know, trade mags. Here at KPFT, we probably get, I don't know, is there a trade magazine we get? You know, Community Radio Today or something, I don't know. So I get Financial Advisor magazine. And there's this one group, a couple of consultants, who advertise incessantly in Financial Advisor magazine and all these. I mean, they must be doing very, very well. But what they're trying to do is to get all financial advisors to go for the affluent client. You must have the affluent client. The affluent client is this rare, sought-after animal, like some rare African, you know, rhino. You must get the affluent client for you to have a successful business. Nauseating to me. You know, rather than coming out and saying, this is a profession that needs to serve all people in this country. And I'll bet you that, you know, 90 to 100% of the financial advisors reading this magazine read this, and they get all hot under the collar that they've got to have affluent, you know, people with tens of millions of dollars, or their practice is worthless. This type of thinking is what is pervasive in our country now. It needs to be gotten rid of. All people deserve medical care. All people deserve an education. All people deserve access to financial advice. 713-526-5738. Actually, I give out the number. We've only got a few minutes left, so let's take who we've got on the board here. Next up, let's take Tony. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Neil.
Yep.
How you doing?
Good.
Anyway, I just got a few points to make. I'll be quick to say this. I get to a lot of people, friends that I talk to, they all seem to very confused. And like this gentleman who called, we all got caught into believe into, well, you should go Democrat, you should go Republican.
Uh-huh.
But right now in this coming elections, it's not really even about that. I mean, we have no more choice but that, right?
Uh-huh.
So what people need to realize is we've been lied by the mass media for too long. And when you hear about, you know, go for Julian,
You're breaking up, Tony.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just want to say, people.
Yeah, real
please,
quick.
Please Google Ron Paul, okay? Just check on Ron Paul and check him out.
Okay, thanks, Tony. Tony's a Ron Paul man. Good enough. You know, the mass media has deceived us, but as Galen Godwin pointed out a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if she actually pointed this out, but it should have been very pregnant in her comments. You know, we deceive ourselves. You want to quit deceiving yourself? Sit down quietly on a meditation cushion for 10, 15 minutes. Do that every day. You'll stop deceiving yourself. The way will become clear. Next up is Dion. Dion, how are you?
Good morning, Leo.
What's going on?
I kind of take issue when you say we need free trade along with fair trade, because it seems to me like you're saying that we need unfair trade along with fair trade.
No. I'm saying
free trade signifies to me what the problem is.
Yep.
The freedom of the powerful to go wherever they want to and generate commerce.
That's right.
But the other countries don't have the right. I mean, in 1992 with John Negroponte and Clinton,
yeah,
which installed NAFTA, I mean, that's the reason why we have a lot of what's going on right now.
No, you and I are in agreement. I may not have stated it well. I believe that trade must be free and fair. You can't have one without the other.
Right. Okay.
We
I'm trying to clear that up.
Yeah. No,
I think I know what you're trying to say, but
yeah,
I have to make sure.
No. It's good.
What we don't need is what they call free trade right now.
I agree. Okay. We're in agreement.
Right.
Thanks, Dion. You can't have laws that protect labor and environment and other matters in one country, and those same things are not protected in another country, because you end up with exactly what's happened. We don't have free trade. We have arbitrage. We have arbitrage. Arbitrage means a risk-free profit is able to be made, and that's what's made when we have people working for, you know, dirt cheap wages in China and other parts of the world, and the environment being abused there, whereas here we have laws that are in place to provide better protection for labor and for environment. And we have capital then flow to these other countries and exploit and arbitrage that disparity. And it's not fair. And I'm not sure it's so free either. And as we know from the poll that I announced last week, 2 out of 3 Republicans now don't think free trade's working. Let's take Christina for some gender diversity. Christina, welcome.
Hi, Leo. I haven't heard you talk about this, but I haven't caught your show enough recently. I'm really intrigued.
What? You haven't caught my show enough recently?
Well, sorry. I have too much of a life right now. But I love your show. I'm really intrigued by Naomi Klein's new book.
Yes.
The Shock Doctrine. And
yes.
I just want to hear you talk about how that kind of disaster capitalism plays into what has been going on with the conservative movement and the Republican Party.
Okay, Christina, thanks. I'll make some comments. Naomi Klein was on Amy Goodman a few weeks ago, and I think that her book on the Shock Doctrine is exactly on target. It's exactly right, in which she proposes that there is an ideology of totally remaking other things, whether it's nations or social programs in this country or foreign cultures, that the doctrine is pronounced and ideological, and it induces shock into a system. And I think that it's exactly what David Brooks is driving at, which is that this has become, the Republican Party has become a party of shock doctrine, as opposed to Burkean in its ways, where change is allowed to evolve, constraints are recognized for what they are, and a realistic view of the means of achieving progress in the world is adopted. You might call it an Eisenhower view. exactly as Eddie, I think it was Eddie, but somebody proposed the last time they saw this kind of conservative Republican. It was Eisenhower. And, of course, Eisenhower was a practitioner of this. He was a practitioner of this type of approach, indeed as a general, since we've been talking about World War II. And if you go back and take a look at the very pragmatic way that Eisenhower approached bringing a second front to Europe, and that carried through in his politics as well. We've only got about another four more minutes. Let's see. Let's take Joe.
Good morning, Neil. How are you?
Good.
Neil, I appreciate the program, but the question I'm hearing is everyone is wondering about the Democrats, Republican, the election, the presidency, but the question, I think someone said that we have bigger fish to fry. Mm-hmm. Try frying this fish. Mm-hmm. Here we are touted the most powerful, the most richest nation in the world. But how did we get in this mess that we're in now? Those are the questions. That's one fish.
By being the most powerful, rich nation. And that's how it happens, Joe. People get full of themselves. Nations get full of themselves. Nations overextend their power. Nations forget about the important fish to fry and start frying things that aren't important. And that's exactly how it happens. And I wouldn't any longer say the U.S. is the most powerful, wealthy nation in the world. Yes, by some measures we can say it. But I think the U.S. has been since the end of the Second World War on its way to settling in as one of a group of nations. And this has been unpalatable for many conservatives and for many Americans as well, who hang on patriotism as an ideology, rather than we are one nation among many in the world. We do some things well, some things not so well, and we need to constantly improve, and we need to look elsewhere as well for solutions.
That's very good, Leo, but just one final compliment. I think that what has happened, that egos have overrode intellect.
Uh-huh.
And because of that,
yep,
this is where we are in the situation that we are in today.
Yep.
Everybody is trying to outdo someone else, but nobody has the sense enough to do it.
Yep. Thanks, Joe. Let's take Rick real quick.
Yeah, part of the problem is we're trained to view these rich people as anything they do is pretty much good. Like, you take the dollar guys from back in World War II who took a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
It meant nothing, because like you said, most of them, they make their money off of investments, and they raise the tax on those guys, the personal income tax,
right,
to something crazy like 90-something percent.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys, even today, are still, you know, basically universally renowned. It's like, oh, man, why don't they make them like they used to, you know, the dollar guys, the dollar CEOs.
Yeah.
And those guys were as big a scumbags as Ken Lay or the rest of them. But we make it out like those guys were great. And it'd be nice if there was a middle party, like a third party that was in the middle that had true range of motion. Because the right isn't going to go too far to the left and vice versa. They're just not. And, you know, I'm basically a Republican, a bad Republican, so yeah, to speak. And I know my people, and I can tell you this, that guy was right. They're never going to vote for a pro-abortion candidate,
mm-hmm,
not in large numbers.
Yep.
So if you had a pro-life Democrat, I think they could win overwhelmingly. I think they could sweep the elections without any problem, because they would bring in a lot of conservatives who don't sweat things like gay marriage and stuff like that. But for some reason, the abortion issue is very, very contentious.
Rick, thanks for the call, as always. Folks, that about does it for today. That does do it for today. Dave, Don, Buddy, I'm sorry we didn't get to your calls. Maybe next week. It's been a pleasure to be with you. www.newcapitalshow.com. Back with you next week. I hope you enjoy this beautiful weather that we're having. And take care. Thanks, Kevin. Great to have you back. KPFT Houston, 91.90.1.
Pioneers 2007 conference, join us in exploring practical solutions at the crossroads of ecological restoration, human health, social service, and the sacred. October 19th through the 21st at Emerson Unitarian Church on Bering Drive between Westheimer and San Felipe. Details at texasbioneers.org. Restoring our ecosystems, preserving cultures, greening economies, building community. The annual Bioneers Conference connects the dots among diverse ideas, peoples, and movements to inspire a life-affirming culture of healing and justice. Explore, connect, and celebrate. October 19th through the 21st. Full details found at texasbioneers.org or by calling 713-768-3422. This is Pacifica Radio 90.1 KPFT Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.